Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. It was one of the biggest crime stories of the decade. Two deadly killers, desperate and on the run. After months of planning, Ricky Matt and David Sweat cut, chopped, coerced, and connived their way out of a maximum security prison in the wilderness of upstate New York and managed to elude police for 3 weeks, sending the region into lockdown and keeping the entire country on edge. The media called it a bold escape for the ages, and veteran true crime writer Michael Benson leads us along the story's every wild path to dig out a tale of adventure, psychology, sex, and brutality. Escape from Dannemora examines the strange case of Joyce Mitchell, the longtime prison employee who had a sexual relationship with at least one of the killers and who smuggled them tools and aided in the escape while they cooked up a plan to kill her husband. In the end, Benson looks closely at conditions at the Clinton Correctional Facility in Dannemora, New York, a crumbling Gothic pile now under investigation for charges of drug trafficking and brutality. The book that we're featuring this evening is Escape from Dannemora, Richard Matt, David Sweat, and the Great Adirondack Manhunt, with my special guest, journalist and author, Michael Benson. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Michael Benson.
Thanks, Dad. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on another, again, fantastic, fantastic book.
Oh, thank you.
Now, I always ask this question, so I'm just curious, what brought you to this story in particular to write this book, Escape from Dannemora?
Well, I think you put it very well in your opening. It's a story that has everything. It's got the adventure of a manhunt through rugged terrain and inclement weather. It's got a sex component to it. And the thing that my book talks about that I think isn't widely known is exactly what David Sweat and Richard Matt did to get into prison in the first place. Because once you understand how brutal and horrible these men were, you realize why there was so much frustration with law enforcement that instead of having the key thrown away, they were handed the key to get out.
Exactly. Now, you also talk about the history of the prison in Dannemora. And so tell us a little bit just about Dannemora and just the history of the facility itself.
Sure. There's been a prison on that spot since 1844. It predates the village around it. And it was originally built as an outpost prison. And the location was considered prime because it was in a valley close to the iron mines and near the hills of Lion Mountain. So the first inmates, they lived in shacks heated by wood in the winter, and they were chained together and forced to build the prison. And once the prison was built, they were put to work mining the iron from the mines. And it eventually developed into a maximum security prison, basically because of it's like real estate. The best place to put a prison is in a place that's very remote, because the surrounding area, the terrain, is not meant for the average human being. And it forms an outer wall. Much like they put Alcatraz on an island in the middle of San Francisco Bay, if you got out of the prison, you still have to deal with the choppy waters. And in
right.
the long run, it was the outer wall of the Adirondacks that captured Matt and Sweat.
Now, you talk about the conditions in Dannemora over the years. There, you talk about in 1929, there was a riot occurred, exposed to the prison's
yes.
brutal conditions. But we, just for the sake of brevity, we have to talk about more modern times with Dannemora. So let's just talk about Dannemora before David Sweat gets there, because David Sweat precedes our Richard Matt by 5 years in Dannemora. So let's go back to Dannemora in more recent times and talk about the conditions that were prevalent in there before we talk about any of the crimes and the history of David Sweat and Richard Matt.
Well, Dannemora was a kinder and gentler place in 2002 than it was in 1920, but that's not saying much. It was still the worst place to do time in New York State, and perhaps in the country, although there are some prisons down in Texas, I think, that give it a run for its money. It was known for its brutality, known for inmates being beaten. It's where they put a lot of gang members from New York City, so there's constant dangers. But on the other hand, the riot that you mentioned brought about some reforms, and one of those reforms was they, instead of just punishing prisoners, they tried to rehabilitate them. And part of that was the tailoring shops. Prisoners, if they chose to, could learn how to sew, make a suit, and perhaps earn a living when they got out, if they were going to get out. And it was in the tailoring shop where Matt and Sweat met Joyce Mitchell, who turned out to be their co-conspirator in the escape.
Now, you talk about the conditions. You talk about they want to rehabilitate prisoners, but I don't know if everybody's familiar with what that entails. And again, like maybe somebody could have a skill, but you're looking at, and as you provide in the book, there's some very, very dangerous people, like you remember the gang members, but also famous guys like Lucky Luciano that have been
right.
in Dannemora. So these are not less serious people, despite being called the Clinton Correctional Facility. But this, you do talk about the actual conditions brought on by, again, the unusual circumstances that bring people together for years and years, relationships develop. And you also say that some of the restrictions, rules, all of those things go by the wayside or get stretched. So as you do in the book, explain really the conditions in a place like this with dangerous criminals, and despite that, conditions in reality.
Well, I think that one thing that I can't emphasize enough is that what these two guys pulled off was practically impossible, and it's doubtful that any other two prisoners could put their heads together and come up with a plan to get out and then execute it. What you had was two guys with complementary skills, and they used the tension within the prison as a distraction. The guards were worried about gang fights. Nobody was looking at these two guys who, weren't going anywhere for a long time and weren't affiliated with any group. And sure, have fun, be in adjacent cells. And what they did was they created a two-headed monster. You had, Richard Matt is a schmoozer. He's a ladies' man. He can attract people to his cause and get people to do things for him, favors. And David Sweat was a three-dimensional thinker. He could solve puzzles, could read a blueprint from across the room upside down, and he could figure out a way to get out. And Matt's job was to recruit the help they would need to accomplish their plan. So, the conditions at the prison are important in the sense that there was a focus of concern at the time of the escape, but it was not on the escapees.
Before we talk about the escape, as you do, and this is the information that people are not aware of, and this is horrifying stuff, you talk about the early life of David Sweat and how he became a planner, and then you have the shining example of what he does with these skills with his friends Nobinger and Duvall and Ness's Fireworks in Grand Bend, Pennsylvania. So tell us about a little bit about his early life, but this robbery in particular, because it's very demonstrative.
Well, Sweat was a bad kid. growing up, juvenile delinquent. And as many do, he graduated to become a bad young adult. He's in a small town down near Binghamton, New York, with two of his buddies. And they're stealing cars and RVs, and they're living in the woods at a place they're calling One Dirt Road. And it's a remote spot. And they fancy themselves, I don't know, commandos or something. They're tearing around the woods in these cars, and they're bragging to each other about it. If they ever get caught by the cops, they're going to shoot it out. You can never have enough guns. So they come up with a plan to go down to a fireworks plant in Pennsylvania, steal a bunch of weapons. They plow a pickup truck right through the front door. Alarm goes off. They load up the truck with the guns, tear out of there, and then they stop at a park closer to home where they're going to transfer the guns from one vehicle to the other. And as they're doing this, Officer Kevin Tarzia of the Binghamton County Sheriff's Department comes pulling up and puts a spotlight on them. So they've been waiting for this moment for a long time. They come up firing. Both Sweat and his cousin shoot the officer. Sweat gets in his car and runs the officer over a few times just to make sure he's dead. And, you know, that's the kind of guy he was. The planning that had gone into the robbery that day gives you an indication of how he thought. He had a diagram of the entire fireworks plant and where exactly the guns were going to be. So when they got inside, they knew exactly where to go and what to take, and they were in and out very quickly. But the idea of shooting it out with cops if they ever got stopped, of course, was a stupid one.
Yeah, and so he does that. He, again, as you say, he likes to talk, and soon after, him and Nabinger are charged with murder, and Sweat's girlfriend, Audrey, cooperates with police. They find the stolen vehicle.
We're calling her Audrey. That's not her real name.
Right. Now, you tell us to avoid the death penalty. Sweat pleads guilty, and he's gets life without parole, and he's packed off to Dannemora in October 2003. Now, tell us, he gets into Dannemora, but the time Richard Matt gets there, he has met this Joyce Mitchell. So tell us a little bit about Joyce Mitchell, a little bit of her background, and when is it that these two meet, David Sweat and Joyce Mitchell, and what's his status by the time Richard Matt gets to Dannemora?
Well, Joyce Mitchell is the femme fatale of the story. She's a civilian employee of the prison. She teaches at the Clinton Correctional Facility's tailor shop. And she was a believer in inmates with benefits. Now, I didn't get a chance to speak with her because I think, as many people know, she would only talk to Matt Lauer of the Today Show. But I spoke to a lot of people who knew her. And sexual intrigue was part of her lifestyle. Her husband, Lyle, was the lover who broke up her first marriage. She always had one husband, one boyfriend. So the fact that she would, commit adultery inside the prison, not that shocking. She believed in inmates with benefits. And she's a plain woman, bespectacled, middle-aged, blonde, a little heavy. And she's been with her husband for 14 years at this point. They live on a nice street in Dickinson Center, about 55 miles from the prison. Her husband, Lyle, also works in the prison. And she becomes Sweat's good friend. And he becomes the prisoner in charge of that tailor shop. But what happens is she ends up taking some nude pictures of herself and gives them to him, and they get caught doing that, and she gets reprimanded, not fired, and he gets moved to a different job. But then his good buddy, Richard Matt, moves in, and by the time he gets there, he already knows from his buddy David that Joyce is susceptible to the attentions of men, and that's all Richard Matt needs to know. He knows he can manipulate this woman. So yeah, she told her first interview with the police after she was questioned, said that she had taken naked photos of her breasts and vagina and given them to Sweat, but she didn't know what he did with them. But we can imagine, I suppose. And during that interview, she said that although she had she'd been punished at work for having an inappropriate relationship with Sweat, it was really Matt that she liked, and he liked her back, and he made her feel special. She brought him all kinds of presents, brownies, cookies. He was able to relay messages to his daughter through her. She would call Matt's daughter and then say, you know, his back's doing fine. You know, did you get the present he sent? That kind of thing. In exchange for this, she gave them hacksaw blades, supposedly at first saying she didn't know what the hacksaw blades were for. She thought maybe they were using them to build frames for the paintings they were doing or something like that. But eventually she figures out that there's an escape, and she thinks she's going to be part of them. She thinks she and her new boyfriend, Richard Matt, who she's fooling around with in the rooms behind the tailor shop, thinks that they're all going to run away together and live happily ever after. Now, Mitchell's coworkers noticed a change in her during the 2 months before the escape. She starts to wear makeup to work. Extra button on her shirt would be unbuttoned. She'd lost weight. She was trying to look more beautiful and sexier while on the job. And this is a pattern in her life. The longtime friends would go, oh, that means a boyfriend. So she's the sex served to make Joyce Mitchell dependent on the prisoners, and the men convinced her that she was their trusted partner, that they were even going to bump off her husband on the way out so that she could drive right off into the sunset with them as a single gal. So, and she even went so far as to call cabins for rent in Vermont, inquiring about rates, because that's where they were going to go. So she lived in a fantasy world right up until the last minute, when all of a sudden the light bulb went on over her head and she realized that she was being duped by these guys. And the chances are, if she showed up on the outside with the getaway car, as she'd promised to do, that she would be killed. They didn't need her. They needed her car. And that caused her an anxiety attack, and she went into the hospital. So instead of supplying the getaway car, she was many miles away. And that ended up being the key factor, because these guys were not outdoorsmen. The last thing they wanted to do was to go into those woods. But they had to. They had no other choice. You know, the getaway car didn't show up. So they went to plan B, even though they didn't have a plan B. And it was because they weren't really – I suspect Richard Madden had never really slept outdoors in his entire life. And Sweat had some scout-like training when he was a kid, and he fancied himself an outdoorsman. He was the guy who was out in the woods driving the RVs around. But they weren't really survivalists. They needed civilization. So they couldn't get too deep into the Adirondacks. They had to stay close to civilization. They used the cabins in the woods and stay close to roads so they would know that they were going in the right direction, that kind of thing. And that was eventually their undoing. But, you know, Joyce Mitchell also, you know, she was responsible for them not getting away, because she backed out at the last minute.
Let's talk about Richard Matt, as you do, because he is the most interesting character here.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
And
yes.
You talk about him growing up in – he was born in 1966 in Buffalo, New York. Now, this is a tragic upbringing, and not
yes.
that it explains anything, but tell us, as you do, about his upbringing before we talk about how he got to Dannemora, and also the very interesting story of David Bentley, the motorcycle cop who had faith in this guy and thought there was some hope. So tell us,
yeah.
as you do, about Richard Matt.
Well, I don't know if you recall, I wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Devil at Genesee Junction, which is about the murders of two girls I knew when I was a kid. That murder took place on June 25th, 1966, which bizarrely was the day Richard Matt was born.
Wow.
So the devil was busy that day. He was abandoned, left in a car, grew up in a series of foster homes, one in particular. And his foster parents were actually pretty good to him. They got him involved in youth activities and sports, which he excelled. But, again, a nature versus nurture type thing. He was the son of a ne'er-do-well, a criminal without a conscience, and that's what he grew up to be himself. And he turned into a little bit of a one-man crime wave in the Buffalo area. He's a bad kid, frightening propensity for violence, and his crimes, as often happens, escalated until he was arrested for kidnapping, torturing, and killing and dismembering a former boss in an attempted robbery that went really, really bad. His partner, that 25-year-old Lee Eugene Bates, who was a part-time strip club employee and criminal justice major at Erie Community College, interesting combination, Bates was largely responsible for the prosecution and getting a conviction against Matt. He agreed to cut a deal and testify against him. But the crime starts because Matt's boss, who has fired him, makes a comment, an offhand comment, that don't worry, I've got $100,000 in a shoebox buried in the basement. Or what he said something like that. And right. It's like the creepy couple of guys in Cold Blood. They got it in their head that these people had money and they weren't going to leave until they got it. And the problem was, Rickerson lied. He didn't have $100,000. There was no treasure in the basement, but Richard Matt was not going to believe it. And William Dickerson was 76 years old, and they put him in the trunk of a car and drove him around, and they'd stop periodically and beat him. Or actually, I shouldn't say that, because Bates, as far as we know, drove. Matt did all of the torture. Then they threw him in the trunk of the car. They drove back and forth between the Buffalo area and Ohio a few times. And he would use the stick, the security device that keeps people from stealing your car. He'd beat him with that. And when he still, the old man still wouldn't say where the money was, Matt upped the torturing. He broke Rickerson's fingers, snapping the aging bones like breadsticks. And when Rickerson howled in pain, that got on Matt's nerves. So after something, it was more than a day, it was like 28 hours of this horrible scene going up and down the roads with this man in agony in the basement screaming. Finally, Matt got sick of it, realized that they were never going to get the money, and they couldn't leave this guy alive because he knew who they were, because they hadn't bothered to wear masks, grabbed him by the head and twisted till it snapped. And that was it for William Rickerson. So they went to a park near the Niagara River and hid the body underneath a wood pile. And then later, Matt decided that wasn't good enough. So he went back with a hacksaw and cut the body up into pieces and threw the gory chunks into the Niagara River. But that's not where the story stops. Because Matt gets away to Mexico in his brother's car. And the car almost makes it to Mexico. It's found abandoned in Texas, crosses into Mexico, and of course he can't stay out of trouble. He just can't do it. He goes to a strip joint in Mexico and sits next to a guy who says he's in the oil business. So this goes ka-ching. Matt says, here's a good guy to rob, follows him into the men's room, and stabs the guy to death and takes his money. Runs out of the bar and gets maybe 100, 200 yards when they catch him. And now he's on the fast track of Mexican justice. They throw him into a hellhole prison where he's tortured with cigarette butts, where he gets a tramp stamp tattoo that says Mexico forever. So the guys down there don't like gringos that much. And all of this despite the fact that there were adults in Matt's childhood and teenage years who thought that he was mad rather than bad and he could be saved. But they were wrong. Matt was a bad, bad man. He was never going to be anything other than someone who hurt and abused people. So another hero of the story is North Tonawanda Chief of Direct Detectives Glenn Gardner. So his astute crime scene investigation at the Rickerson house really led to a major break in the case. He was such a pain in Matt's butt that Matt once tried to put out a hit on the investigator, and the prosecutor was Lou Horemsky. Now, after 10 years of being in the Mexican prison, they're sick of him down there. He keeps trying to get out. He's a pain in the butt. So they give him back, even though nobody asked for him. And he comes back to Erie County, and he's prosecuted for the Rickerson murder 10 years after it happens, which is a really tough thing to do because jurors can find reasonable doubt in 10-year-old memories a lot easier than they can in more immediate ones. Excellent job on all parts down there. The trial itself went on for a very long time. It was very expensive because they were convinced that Matt was going to try to escape. He had a history of escape. He'd been gotten out of the Erie Correctional Facility when a guard, quote, forgot to lock his door, unquote. And he made prison escape attempts down in Mexico. So that extra security, he was wired up with a stun gun. All they did was press a button and he would have, sizzled on the ground for a little while, and that would have kept him from running away. They were afraid that he had friends who were going to invade the courtroom and take him. None of that happened. But when he finally was sent to Dannemora, all of those people in Tonawanda and the whole Buffalo area really, really didn't want to ever hear his name again. They were pretty sick of him. And he meets David Sweat and Dannemora. They realize that they've got things in common. They're thinkers. And they put their heads together. And, within days of meeting each other, they start thinking about how do we get out of here. Between the two of them, they came up with a plan.
We're going to use this, Michael, as an opportunity just to stop for a couple seconds to talk about the sponsors of this fine program. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. One more time to try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. The other sponsor is Blue Apron, and Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. And their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. They achieve this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States, and as a result, seafood is sourced sustainably, beef, chicken, and pork come from responsibly raised animals, and produce is sourced from farms that practice regenerative farming. Blue Apron can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S., every week, they send you all of the ingredients that you need to make your own home-cooked gourmet meals. For less than $10 per person per meal, they send you all the pre-portioned ingredients, and you choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you'll never get bored. And you can customize your recipes each week based on your preferences. They have several delivery options, so you can choose what fits your needs, and there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. And there's a Blue Apron freshness guarantee that promises every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, and they'll make it right. Now, as featured upcoming meals, I tried the sweet and sour salmon with bok choy, carrot, and ginger fried rice. There was also a spinach and fresh mozzarella pizza with olives, bell peppers, and ricotta salata. This stuff is just amazing stuff that you would never think of yourself. They give you all of the step-by-step recipes You follow all the ingredients, and believe me, I can do it myself. Anyone can. Gourmet meals made by yourself for less than $10 per meal. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/murder. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/murder. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. When we last spoke, Michael, we were talking about the conditions that were ripe for these two people to get together with complementary skills, with a concerted plan, with this woman that they knew could be an asset, these people cunning and clever, and like you say, complementary skills. How was it? What's the first thing they did? It's very interesting how they got adjacent cells. Tell us what they did besides get that cell and how they got those cells together, and what is the first thing they did in this escape plan in a practical way?
Well, they got into adjacent cells by bribing the guy who was next to Matt so that Sweat could move into the cell, or the other way around, I forget which way it went. And the first thing they did was they built back doors to their cells, and in order to try to cut a hole in your cell, you have to know ahead of time that there's something on the other side that's going to be part of the escape. I mean, if there's just a concrete wall there, and on the other side is sky, you're going to have to tie sheets together to get out. But that wasn't the way it was. When they cut through their cell walls, there was a sizable infrastructure crawl space that's there so that repairmen can fix the heating system and the electric system and all the stuff that they needed to do. And it was right on the other side of their cells. Now, every night for months after the holes are made, Sweat crawled out of his cell and worked on finding and creating a way out. And now during much of that time, it was Matt's job to get them the tools they needed, to get them the automobile they would need once they got out. And his other job was to lose weight, because Sweat finds that the only way out is to crawl through the heating pipe, which is turned off in the spring. And Matt's too chubby to fit. So he loses 30, 40 pounds during the weeks leading up to the escape, so that he will be able to fit through the pipe. And even so, it was a tight squeeze. And during the actual escape, Sweat had to pull him through, tie him and pull him. At one point, I guess when he was trying to get through the pipe, his pants came down, and that was a big laugh. But it's estimated that Sweat crawled out of his cell 85 times. He wasn't in his cell for any night for 3 months. And he crawled back for, only 84 of them. Now, we're supposed to believe that he did this only with very primitive tools. It says he used, hacksaws and drill bits and things like that. And if you look at the pipe they cut the hole in, not only to get in the pipe, but then another hole to get out of the pipe on the other side of the wall, it looks like power tools are really necessary. And the reason he knew ahead of time that there was a crawl space back there was because one of the prison guards showed him, "Hey, sure, come on, take a look. Let's change your electricity a little bit so that you can better paint." They were using, they're both very skilled artists, and they were painting and using that to give to guards and civilian employees in exchange for favors. And Sweat says that there were often guards went back into the crawl space area to smoke. And he remembers one time he was down there trying to figure out how to get out of the prison, and he had to dodge a cigarette butt that came flying down from an upper level. So yeah, the escape route starts with a hole in the back of the cell, and then there was a ladder went all the way down into the sub basement. Then there was they had to get into the heating pipe, which took like a month of work right there. Crawl through the pipe, which goes through the outer wall of the prison, the 40-foot wall, go under it. And then from while inside the pipe, cut a hole to get out. And he has to know once he gets out of the pipe, he's going to be able to get to another ladder, which is going to lead up to a manhole that lets him out in the middle of a street intersection a block and a half away from the prison. So all of this is taking place in an atmosphere in which the prison employees believe that escape is impossible. I mean, why do bed checks? Where's the guy going? Nobody followed any rules. The generations had gone by since anybody knew what the rules were. And it seems kind of unbelievable that this guy could leave his cell 85 times and then never even come close to getting caught. And he was doing things down there that must have made noise, too. Like Governor Cuomo, one of his early comments was, a lot of people spill out of heavy sleepers around here.
Yeah.
But anyway, they emerge at the intersection of Buck and Barker Streets in the peaceful village of Dannemora. And they were in for a surprise. They expected Joyce Mitchell to be there with the car, but she was a no-show. They were carrying their stuff in a guitar case. Figured they would look less suspicious. They looked like traveling musicians. And one of the things she had smuggled into them was 70 containers of pepper, which they were constantly sprinkling behind them, thinking that that would throw off the canine searchers that would be coming eventually. So they against their will, they started to go across backyards and stuff, and immediately they got yelled at. "Hey, get off my property," some guy says. "Sorry, we're on the wrong street. We don't know where we are." And they head into the woods, which is up and down mountains. And all this is really tough on Richard Matt's legs. He's not in good condition. So as they get deeper and deeper further from civilization, they start to squabble a little bit because Sweat's only thought is on continuing to be free. And Matt, who's an alcoholic on the outside, says, "Yeah, let's find a drink. Let's find a place where there's a warm mattress to sleep on." So they time at a series of cabins that aren't being used. And eventually they leave evidence of themselves behind when they leave. And that's when the noose starts to tighten around them, when they get a positive DNA match from the spittle in a sink that they found, you know, in one of the cabins. And they said, "Well, this is about a day old." And that really helped because it has, for the first 2 weeks of the search, nobody had any idea which direction they went in. And it was really like searching for, two needles in a very, very big haystack.
Now, what you talk about is, too, and we just glossed over it, is the incredible reaction from this. First, again, right out of the movies, when they look and there's a couple dummies in the cells, and then and that response. And then you talk about the escalating volunteers or the search team going from 700 to 1,000 to... So
right.
What is the reaction in the community of Dannemora? Again, these people unsuspecting, believing that nothing like this could ever happen, including all the law enforcement. What's the law enforcement response, the media response, the community response, as you describe?
Well, from law enforcement was really admirable because you had many, many different agencies all working together and with remarkably little confusion and few squabbles. And I heard that was because in that area, crime is not really the problem. The problem is nature. And the safety officers up there often work together because they're not catching criminals as much as they're just helping people. There's an ice storm. We all get together. We go rescue people who are stuck in places. And so teamwork is part of the pattern of that area anyway. And they got up to about 1,200 people who were involved in the manhunt. And the community really, really was supportive. Once they found out these guys were out there searching in the woods, donations came in, restaurants gave free food. Everybody wanted to be helpful, and they were. The other factor is the weather's just horrible. It's just raining sheets the entire time. The helicopters are rarely used as part of the search. But instead of morale getting low because of the weather, the manhunters were kind of they got pumped up by it a little bit, because they knew if they were miserable, the guys they were chasing were twice as miserable.
Yeah. Now, how fast does it take to discover, and how do they discover Joyce's participation in this? I mean, they're looking for how on earth did they get out of here? So they see the escape route,
right,
but they know that there's indications that there's other participation. They have to check that out. How fast and how do they discover her participation, and what's their response?
Very quickly. They find out about her while interviewing Matt's daughter. And she says that she had gotten some texts and a phone call from a lady who worked in the prison relaying messages from Dad, and her name was Joyce Mitchell. And the second they hear that name, bell goes off, because Joyce Mitchell was brought up for punishment once because she had a personal relationship with David Sweat involving photographs.
Sure.
So they bring her in, and her first story rings of the truth. I mean, that's the story where she says that she was lonely, she was depressed, she kind of fell in love with Richard Matt. She was looking forward to running away. It was a fantasy, and then the last second she realized it wasn't going to happen. As time went on, of course, and her lawyers talked to her more and more, she changed her tune, and all of a sudden it was, Richard Matt's abuse, and he terrorized her and said he was going to kill her husband if she didn't do what he said. And that's the story she's sticking with now. But she let her fantasies get away with her. And luckily for us and for herself, I'm sure she did back out at the last second, because David Sweat might have been satisfied with tying her up and leaving her by the side of the road, but I'm thinking Richard Matt would have killed her.
Hmm. The other thing was that there was the other part of the plan was David, I believe, or had given her pills to give to her husband, Lyle, to knock him out, to facilitate further.
Right, so he wouldn't report her missing right away.
Right.
And give them some extra time to head down the road. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. Are those pills the same pills that were going to kill him? Were they going to knock him out? Were they going to go over to the house and bump him off? Or was that all just talk? We don't know, because that part of the plan never manifested itself. I'll tell you one story I like. The story of Joshua Lamedy. Joshua Lamedy was a good kid, in his early 20s, got a young wife and babies. And he worked a couple of fast food jobs to make ends meet in the town of Malone, where he was born and grew up. But he bears a strong facial resemblance to David Sweat. And for 3 weeks, every time he would try to walk to his job, screaming up, and guys would be pointing guns at him. And so no one was happier to know that the crisis was over, then Joshua Lamedy's life could go back to normal.
You also talk about the two prisoners on the run. One's much older, you say. One's not in good shape. But they are also, you say that David Sweat is totally sick of hearing Richard Matt talk about murdering this person, murdering that person. And so tell us about a little bit of this, how the relationship sours, and also what David decides to do and what Matt decides to do.
Yeah, I think that while they were staying in one of the cabins, Matt says, what are we going to do if somebody shows up? And David Sweat says, we're going to run away. No, let's kill him. And that's pretty much Richard Matt's solution to all problems, all obstacles, can be murdered away. And Sweat sees that as just another way to leave a trail. And Sweat's in a lot better shape. He's done most of the work digging out of the prison in the first place. I think Matt only goes down into the hole twice before the actual escape. So he's done all the work. He could have escaped on his own, but he was a man of his word. He went back and got Matt, as he promised he would. And the thinking was that Matt really had done his share because Joyce Mitchell was going to be outside waiting with a car. That was Matt's responsibility to get that done. But the second that they all of a sudden become killers on the run in the woods, in the mountainous terrain, the difference between their ages and then their physical capabilities becomes really obvious, and Sweat is being bogged down by Matt at every turn. It's like having a ball and chain on. And the other problem is that every time they go into a cabin where there's just a little relief and get some warmth and dryness, Matt gets drunk. So not only has he got the fatso who can't walk fast anymore, Richard Matt inebriated and unable to really function well. So there comes a time when Matt's very, very drunk. He falls down in the woods, doesn't get up, and Sweat says, "That's it, I'm done," and just splits. Heads off in another direction. So, and after that, Matt does not last very long at all. He's got a shotgun, and he wants to see if it works. He goes out and shoots at a camper driving by. And that again, that brings law enforcement around, and now the noose is really tight. They know he's in there someplace because the report of the shot. When did the shot take place? Just now. So they're on the site, and Matt's lying on the ground in his stomach with his shotgun. I think he only had one shell. He doesn't have a second shell. Gun's empty, but he's pointing it anyway. And he makes a fatal mistake, which is he coughs. And the manhunters hear it. And a guy from the Texas Border Patrol, whose unit was on hand to help with the manhunt, is the sharpshooter who puts Matt away. Puts three shots into the same hole in his head.
Right.
Even though Matt's obviously dead when they get to him, and he's reeking of alcohol, the first thing they do is they pull the shotgun away from him. And that's it. And, there's no sigh of relief because as far as they know, Sweat's nearby with their temple in his crosshairs. They don't know that he's miles away at this point heading north towards the Canadian border.
Now, how you say that they don't know, so they clear this area finally. They're precautious and they make sure that he's not in the area. So clues are left because obviously they can't speak to Matt. So what clues are left and where do they think he's likely heading to?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you're asking. There's a little bit of a back to the drawing board. Because they tighten the search, form a circle around where Matt was killed, and all head in towards the center. And they realize as it gets smaller and smaller that Sweat has slipped the outer perimeter of their operation. He ends up lasting two more days, and it's a little bit of a coincidence. State Trooper Sergeant Jay Cook is supervising a search team on the Coveytown Road near the town of Constable. And it's 30 miles. He's 30 miles from Dannemora now. He's 16 miles from where Matt was killed, and only a mile and a half from the Canadian border. And Cook's driving his vehicle on patrol, and he spots a man in a camouflaged outfit walking along the wood line. So he stops the car and he watches as the guy in fatigues walks into a newly cut alfalfa field. Cook stops the vehicle, pursues on foot, gets a strong visual, realizes this is it, this is the guy. So now when Sweat realized he's been recognized, he made a run for it, heading for the trees. and the officer knew that if the prisoner made it to the trees, he was likely to evade capture and maybe cross the border into Canada, and then the whole search would go on and on. So Cook says, stop or I'll shoot. Sweat doesn't stop, but Cook does, and he's a marksman. So he takes aim, takes a deep breath, squeezes off a shot, which hits Sweat but doesn't knock him down. And then the second one, Sweat falls to the ground. He's wounded, but he survives and is able to give us his version of events. Now, somewhat controversially, he was prosecuted for his escape and placed in permanent solitary confinement. Now, that's controversial because people say he's already serving life without parole. How do you punish a guy? Further than that, there's no death penalty. But the prosecutor said, when you commit a crime in this state, you get prosecuted. That's how it is. So Sweat may have been able to burrow his way out of the belly of the beast once, but he's going to be in solitary confinement for the rest of his life, and that means the good guys won in the end.
Part of the interesting thing for people watching, and there was millions watching, and this transfixed all
yes.
kinds of people in the audience, was the recreation of the actual route, going in there and bringing cameras in and showing the actual route, how these guys escaped from this prison, this 20-minute
yes.
journey.
Well, you know, it makes me think of Governor Cuomo, because he was there a day after the escape, and he's walking along in the catwalks and with a camera crew behind him, just be on top of the action. But the problem is, you know, the crime scene investigators really hadn't gone over the area yet, so Cuomo's touching things and stepping on things he probably shouldn't have been. As it turned out, you know, no big deal, but you know, they didn't know that at the time. please don't go down there yet, Governor. Okay, never mind. The governor did what he wanted to do. Yeah, and then, okay. But then they made a videotape of the actual, so we can all go on YouTube and experience just how claustrophobic it was to take the 20 minutes it took to get from their cells to that manhole out on Buck Street.
Now, you also, I mean, this book has just got so much of the background story of Dannemora before all the people that were in Dannemora, but also the cost of this thing. You put this at $12.6 million.
I think that's probably a low estimate. The things like
wow.
overtime for state troopers wasn't factored into that. And yeah, no, it was very expensive. Oh, you know, and that's another thing with Governor Cuomo. I don't want to sound like I'm picking on him, but he had a budget that didn't allow prison wardens to declare their own lockdowns. Now, about 3-4 days before the escape, there's a gang fight at Clinton Correctional, and the warden wants to declare a lockdown. He calls Albany for permission, and they say, no, it costs too much money. Now, if he had been able to call his own lockdown, there would have been searches of all the cells, and the back doors to Matt and Sweat's cells would have been discovered, and there would have been no escape. So in trying to save money, they end up creating a situation that ended up costing him, you know, millions and millions of dollars. You know, penny wise, pound foolish, as they say.
While you're on that, too, what you had mentioned in the book, too, is that people might find this either laxed or sort of ridiculous, that they couldn't even frisk people coming in that were non-staff
right.
into that prison.
It's, and everybody knew the rules, and there was so much cheating going on. I mean, it just was no big deal. When Joyce Mitchell brings in the hamburger meat with the hacksaw blade hidden in it, she gives it to guard Gene Palmer, says, could you give this to Matt for me? He says, sure. Because Matt and he have been buddies for a long time. You know,
sure.
That's a problem maybe with having a prison that's in such a remote area, is that all of the civilians who live there work in the prison. And after a while, I think the adversarial nature of their roles is blurred by sense of community, like we're all in this together.
Yeah.
A lot of the prison employees saw the inmates more than they saw their own families. And,
yeah.
you know, guards have friends who are inmates. And in this case, that turned out to be a key factor, because you've got a guard kind of giving these guys a little tour of what's behind their cells, gives them a preview of, hey, this is the first step in your escape plan.
you talk about and discuss, because again, it's not a done deal, it's an issue, about the power tools used or not used in this escape. And it was all about, and you also talk about the toolbox found. So tell us about all of this.
Yeah, well, you know, the complicating factor here is that Sweat maintains that no power tools were used, that the holes in those pipes, the thick metal, was done entirely with little hacksaw blades bought at Kmart, with cotton wrapped around the end so that he wouldn't hurt his hand while he was sawing, and that he cut one of these holes while lying inside the pipe. It seems impossible. And there was a toolbox down there that had been left behind by some construction workers, and they picked the lock with a paper clip. And so there were tools available. And the culture at Dannemora tools weren't bad. One of the ways you rewarded prisoners for being good is you let them have little projects. They'd go out in the back field and, you know, build a birdhouse, or, you know, Matt and Sweat were making frames for their paintings. So, you know, idle hands were what they were worried about. Guys with tools were busy and occupied and happy. But having tools that aren't really being accounted for, another factor that was used and abused by the guys who were looking to get over and get out.
Now, other than that, Palmer, which got in a lot of trouble, the Officer Palmer from the CCF, what was Joyce Mitchell? Other than she tried to gain sympathy with these interviews with Matt Lauer on the Today Show, but Dr. Phil didn't buy into it. But really, what was the fate of Joyce Mitchell in terms of the court?
Well, Joyce Mitchell was convicted of criminal facilitation and was given 2.5 to 7 years in prison. I suspect, but she just had her first parole hearing and she was denied parole. My thinking is she's going to serve about 2 years, and then somebody's going to realize that she should make the training film for future civilian employees of how to avoid the pitfalls of trusting inmates. That inmates are con men supreme. They will find your weak point and they will exploit it. I think she's probably would better serve New York State in that capacity than sitting in a prison cell someplace. On the other hand, I kind of think that probably Joyce is handling prison better than most because she's just familiar with being inside a prison.
And what was the, as you write, the response from her husband Lyle through this whole thing and to this
case? No. Lyle is the patient of a saint. Patience of a saint. He has stayed true, but his support has had a limit. He's obviously very hurt, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens when she gets out, how much longer that relationship lasts. I know that their son has had problems during the time that she's been away, legal problems. He's kind of gotten himself into a little bit of trouble. So the family's not doing well until post-escape. It'll be interesting to see if Lyle sticks with her faithfully, or if she's driven a wedge in their relationship that really can't be healed.
You also talk about the attempted overhaul of the system and more than refinements that are needed. Again, it's just an overhaul of the system and reexamination of what went wrong, but also what they could do, the money that they could put in to make sure this never happens again. What was their response, and what's the result?
Well, the one-year anniversary of the escape, the New York State Inspector General's report was released, and it blamed the escape on longstanding systemic failures in management and oversight. The culture was such that when, asked about sticking to regulations, many CCF employees admitted they didn't know what the regulations were. And at one point, inspections of, CCF's tunnel infrastructure had been frequent, but none had been done since 1995. weekly inspections of cell integrity, any one of which would have busted Matt Sweat, discontinued so long ago that corrections officers didn't know they ever existed. There are estimated 400 required checks of Sweat's cell that would have caught him sneaking out the back door but didn't. They revealed that Joyce Mitchell smuggled more than 70 containers of pepper into the prison. You know, 70 containers of pepper. That's a lot of pepper. One of the key items the prisoners were using in their escape was a tape measure. The tape measure was to measure the girth of Richard Matt to see if he would fit through the pipe.
Yeah.
She also got them a map of the area, although they forgot to bring it when they left it behind by accident. They used a long orange extension cord that Sweat used to hook up an electric fan and light during his work. Now, the report thoroughly itemized the proper procedures at CCS and supported their central thesis that new regulations were not as important as wiping out the culture of carelessness at CCF that prevented the old regulations from being followed. So that,
right.
In a nutshell, the Inspector General recommended that staff be trained better. I think that's where they're going to probably use Joyce Mitchell as an example. There will be increased camera surveillance. To stringently follow regulations already in place, inspect the catwalk and tunnel system more than once a year, hopefully monthly, supply an oversight of the corrections to ensure the integrity of the system, use canines to detect contraband, you know, search civilians when they come in and out, you know, keep a closer eye on tools left behind by contractors and maintenance people, you know, better oversee the tailor shops. One key factor about the tailor shop is on the third floor of the building. And if you looked out the window, you could see over the wall onto the streets of the village of Dannemora. So in theory, you know, they could have stood there at that window and said, there's where the pipe goes and there's the manhole. They would have a visual from outside the prison to know where to head in order to get up and above ground again. And to revamp the honor system, I think the honor system is probably going to be abolished. I mean, these guys should have been on death row if there was a death penalty, and instead they were, because they had behaved themselves in the recent past, they were in the honor block, which allowed them extra privileges, civilian clothes. They could wander around outside their cells more frequently. And the last recommendation of the Inspector General's was to severely discipline and effectively counsel officers and civilian employees who broke the rules.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I think it's a little bit unlikely that it's going to happen again because it is very hard to do. And it's going to be a long time before the Clinton Correctional Facility returns to its ways of complacency and arrogance. There's no thinking that nobody can get out of here anymore. They know it's possible now.
Mm-hmm. You also, though, at the same time, sort of as an alarm, you talk about situation with some gang members in Baltimore. Tell us a little bit about that, just to a cautionary tale.
What gang members?
Well, you talked about some gang members again doing something similar in terms of even worse in a Baltimore correctional center.
Oh yeah, well you know, it's a couple of times that year there was another one out in California where again it was a woman. Employee of the prison who was helping out, and I guess us people on the outside are law-abiding people find it a little bit unusual, but there's a lot of romance going on in prisons. Makes me think of the movie Raising Arizona, where the female corrections officer falls in love with the guy who's constantly in and out of jail.
It was interesting to talk about the access, as you do in the book, about that Joyce Mitchell could have maybe 40 minutes in a room with Sweat or Matt. You talked about sex was, and the inmates knew. They cracked jokes about that 40 minutes. What could they possibly be doing together? So there was
sure. Well, and that's because female employees are given places of privacy. Much more so than male employees would be. then there are little hidey places to go. And if you're there for 10, 15 years, you know where they are. It strikes me as a little bit unusual, but I guess no matter where you go, there's going to be office romance.
Yeah. The other thing you did, too, is that what's interesting in this story is the public response in Dannemora and surrounding area, and to the point where 7 officers or people involved in the search were given awards, and then later Jay Cook couldn't come, but he was given an award, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, the community up there was really great about expressing their thanks. I mean, when the manhunt was officially over, when Sweat was captured, and there was a sort of a convoy of law enforcement heading back to where they came from, the people of the area stood out on their front lawns holding signs saying thank you. And you know, the heroes of the story were not forgotten. And everybody was very, very grateful that so many of the men and women of the law enforcement in the area were put in such long hours to and really pulled it off. Against all odds, they got these guys without anybody getting hurt except for the escapees themselves. And, boy, that was a best-case scenario.
You do examine, too, the phenomena in this book, which is, again, something new for me and the readers, in the phenomena of the grooming by these psychopaths, these cunning criminals that have spent, as you do say with Matt and Sweat, spent the majority of their life in prisons, these guys. So
right.
They're very good at what they were doing, and they have a goal. But you talked about the actual art they did with corrections officers.
Yeah, it's called Downing the Duck. It works just like any con artist. You find a mark, you figure out psychologically what their weakness is, and then you exploit that weakness to your own benefit. And it's very, very cunning. Gene Palmer, it was apparently by all accounts a good guy. And why he would befriend a psychopath like Richard Matt, hard to say, but Matt was good at being one of the guys, making other guys feel comfortable with him when he wanted to. I mean, he could turn off the evil briefly. And and being a ladies' man by nature, he had no problem seducing Joyce Mitchell. It was a piece of cake. The fact that she was putting herself in a situation where she was going to ruin her marriage and ruin her job and her career. None of it occurred to her. She was just, she was in love with him.
Yeah.
So, and of course, not all prisoners are as skilled at it as these two guys, but that's what inmates do. They have nothing but time. They could sit around and think up plans of how to accomplish things that are far more detailed and patient. Than anybody on the outside would be able to handle. I mean, if you have freedom, you're not going to spend months at a time trying to figure out how to bribe somebody with cigarettes. You know, it's a different world.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, how you talk about from the entire escape and all of the machinations that led to this escape. And now you say, like you say, the unique nature of these two people to bring this escape to fruition. But you also talk about, again, the unique characters of these two perpetrators to be able to pull this off. And luckily, thankfully, they did not shoot him and he was alive. And I'm sure there was an incredible pressure that you didn't really write about and probably law enforcement didn't talk about for this guy to give as much of the real information regarding before the escape and during the escape, the entire escape itself. That was incredible and invaluable information for this book and for the resolution of this case, wasn't it?
One of the reasons why Jay Cook is a hero is he took down Sweat without taking him out. Because
right.
if both prisoners had been killed, there would be a big question mark about how they did it. And as it is, Sweat really does fill in a lot of detail for us, but not all detail, because he knows he's going to have to spend the rest of his life under the care of corrections officers. So he's not going to rat anybody out. If there's anybody that's been involved, that was involved other than the guy, people who were already caught, you know, he's going to keep that mum. He's never going to say, so-and-so gave me power tools. I mean, there's even been a rumor that somebody else cut the holes in the pipe for him, because he bribed them. But we're never going to know, because that's, he knows that if he starts squealing on guys, life could get hard for him, harder.
Yeah, harder. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a fascinating tale, Michael. Thank you very much for coming on and talking about your latest escape
you,
from
Dan.
Dannemora. It's been a pleasure, as it
always
is, but thank you very much for this. And for those that might want to look at some of your other work, or is there a Facebook page for this? Tell us how people might contact you or look at other work of yours.
Amazon.com. I have my own page on there. I'm the Michael Benson with a beard. Because there are more than one Michael Benson, so right. But I'm the one who does true crime, some sports books, a book about the Grateful Dead. And, please, buy my books. My son's still in college, and my daughter's getting married, so I need some money.
You need money.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for coming on and doing this. And you have a great day, and I know I'll be talking to you again soon, because you've got kids in college and bills to pay. So.
That's right. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you, Michael.
Yep, goodbye. Bye.